I do think the technology that could achieve a right answer will be readily available relatively soon. I don't think that's the barrier. If we knew the information that it needed to come to a correct answer, I think that we could do that. Like the actual technology barrier, I don't think is going to be the issue. I think it's going to be the domain knowledge associated with how can we confidently detect individual response variation. What does it mean to respond individually? What does it mean to have a favorable response to one condition versus the other? How are you making sure that that is not associated with sampling variation, sampling error, measurement error, all these sorts of things that get really complicated when you're talking about an N of one kind of case.
Welcome back, Mobs and Mo's listeners, for another week here with Drew and Alex. This week's episode and this week's guests are two guys that I have followed for a very long time and was very excited to get them on. Alex, tell us a little bit about who we're talking to this week.
Yeah. So Drew definitely has a crush on these guys.
He's two, been talking to two me about crushes, them. Two big crushes.
He's been talking to me about them and their content for a long time. Got me following their page. They're both from Data Driven Strength. We talked to Zach and Josh, and they said to go ahead and use their bios from their website for the intro. And I didn't look at their bios at a time. I didn't realize that they have the briefest bios of all time.
This is Zach. This is Josh.
Yeah. So Zach is founder slash coach for Data Driven Strength. He has a master's in exercise science and is a certified strength and conditioning specialist. He is a graduate research assistant at Florida Atlantic University's Muscle Physiology Lab. Josh is also co-owner and coach, and this bio is going to really surprise you. He has a bachelor's in exercise science and is a certified strength and conditioning specialist, and he is a graduate research assistant at Florida Atlantic University's Muscle Physiology Lab.
But if you guys are familiar at all with, I mean, we mentioned data-driven strength, so I came across their work. I couldn't even tell you how, but several years ago, and was really keyed into what they were preaching at the time, which was flipping traditional strength training on its head a little bit and going after lower RPE versus always maxing out, always hitting heavy weights. What are we really chasing after? You know, when we think of rate of force production, how does that translate to resistance training prescriptions? And that is something that we definitely key in on with our conversation today with Zach and Josh, but obviously we go a number of different places as well. For me, though, and folks that are working alongside with us on Long and Strong, you'll see these types of strategies implemented, because what my big takeaway was as I got introduced to the data-driven strength methodology was, hey, here's a way that you can introduce resistance training in a concurrent training plan such that an athlete can do what they need to do from a strength training perspective without totally overtaxing themselves in a way that they might traditionally, if they just went after, you know, a 5-3-1 program or any of your kind of standard heavy lifting programs. Here is a way that is evidence-based. We can see it play out in the literature, and you have plenty of adaptation currency left over to go after endurance-based goals, work capacity-based goals, just other things that aren't completely depleting you like a very, very heavy powerlifting training program might. That was how I got turned on to these guys. And so to have them come on the podcast and chat with us was awesome.
And there's some pretty cool stuff in here. There's, like Drew mentioned, they do a little bit of turning traditional notions of RPE on their head. But also there's some good conversation in that these are not guys who've had a lot of exposure to the tactical human performance space or the tactical community at all. So we got to have some neat conversation about how the particular principles they're coming at from a pretty specifically powerlifting standpoint actually have tremendous applicability to broader communities like tactical, where there are competing demands in addition to the training that somebody might be doing or other types of training they need to do beyond barbell stuff. So I thought it was a pretty valuable conversation about how you can take some principles they've discovered from one angle and apply them in a different way.
Well, the other thing too, and we get into this sort of towards the tail end of the conversation, but I mean, it's in the title, data-driven strength. Like these guys, by virtue of just being really intelligent human beings, but also being immersed in the literature of resistance training, one of the stones that we wanted to turn over was, how do you bridge the gap between what we see in strength and conditioning literature and what we know works objectively, subjectively in the strength and conditioning field. And I think that the insights that they have as far as how to understand research, how to implement research, how to be data-driven versus data-based and super rigid off of the findings or a little bit more nuanced. I think that you'd be hard-pressed to find two better individuals to speak to that complexity around strength and conditioning.
So before we roll into the episode, I just want to shout out to, they have their own podcast. They have their own blog on their website and stuff. Tons of good content if you want to dive deeper after listening to the conversation.
Enjoy. Down to business. Guys, I want to ask you this question because I've read this stuff that you guys put out on the website. Obviously, you've become, well, you are, you know, relatively popular.
He has a huge crush on you guys professionally.
Big man crush professionally. But I want to kick this off by just starting at square one and discussing sort of the traditional powerlifting model of resistance training that I think most folks know and love. You guys, I think, refer to as the threshold model versus what you put out, generally speaking, when we think of like lower RPE and how all that plays, if that makes sense.
Yep. Sure. So, you know, long, long ago, and when the first periodization text was, you know, the dust blew off the cover and people cracked open the first page, you have two beautiful lines of volume and intensity. And you have the volume line that slowly declines over the course of a training cycle. And you have this intensity line that gradually increases over time. That's kind of traditional periodization at its finest. And when we think of intensity, for the most part, people were thinking originally like the percentage of 1RM on the bar. So if I can lift 100 kilos, the, you know, percentage of my 1RM that I'm using on any given set, let's say 80%, I'd be using 80 kilos on the bar there. That's kind of the relative loading, or some people call it the relative intensity. Terminology is definitely not clear there, but that's kind of really as simple as it was. And then people started to, you know, of course, thanks to Mike T and the emergence of using RPE, which is basically just a way to quantify how hard a set is. So you're basically just saying at the end of a set, how many reps in the tank do I have? You know, there's a couple different ways you can quantify that, but that's ultimately what you're asking yourself. The original kind of periodization model didn't further stratify what intensity meant. It just continued to be intensity, but didn't really take into account the different components of intensity, whether that's the load on the bar or this RPE. So what, you know, we've been, you know, kind of piggybacking on some ideas from some other people for a while and kind of talking about this, where we kind of do split those lines and kind of think about it maybe in a little bit different way, where the kind of the central idea there is, for powerlifting is kind of the specific goal you mentioned there. We guess we can generalize that a little bit more to just maximal strength in general. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, what you're, the adaptation you care about there is like a short, brief instance of maximal force production. So that's ultimately what you're kind of trying to do, is improve our ability to produce the absolute amount of force as possible, kind of independent of time. Generally, it's going to be a pretty short event there. For the most part, intensity or the load is going to be perfectly kind of mapped to that, where the greater load on the bar, the greater amount of force you're going to be producing. So the specific adaptation to impose demands there, principle of specificity, all those kind of, you know, basic exercise prescription kind of principles all kind of align there. And that's where that normal periodization model kind of made sense. But when we think about the RPE or the RIR, the proximity to failure, whichever kind of term you want to go with there, and you think about that from the kind of principle of specificity perspective, kind of coming back to force, if I had a given percentage of my 1RM on the bar, let's say that is that 80% mark. So I have 80 kilos on the bar with 100 kilo max, and I perform a set to failure, kind of counterintuitively, as I get closer to failure, I'm actually producing less force than on that first repetition, given I'm trying as hard as I can. So the kind of concept there is that independently, RPE doesn't necessarily seem to map onto the principle of specificity. So this is kind of where that, at least the initial idea of the low RPE for strength kind of started. And there's a lot of nuances and kind of practical limitations of that kind of simplistic line of thinking. But ultimately, it does kind of support what we see in the research in terms of like a nice narrative for the moment. Obviously that can change with more research and more understanding, but for the, you know, point in time, kind of going with that force production model, specificity seems to map on pretty well to the longitudinal outcomes and research that we see, and saying that ultimately out of those variables of intensity, when we split things, the variable that seems to be much more predictive of maximal strength gains is the load on the bar rather than RP within itself. Whereas that is really just a byproduct of the load on the bar and the number of repetitions that you choose to perform, but doesn't really seem to augment strength gains independently. The only additional piece of this that's a little bit confusing that I always like to clear up is that if I have a heavy load on the bar, so let's say I have 90% of my 1RM on the bar, the amount of repetitions in reserve that I can have, or the maximum distance away from failure that I can achieve, is going to decrease as that load increases. So it's there can be a way that you get closer to failure that's from increasing the load on the bar, or you could get closer to failure by performing more repetitions within a set, and that would be accumulating fatigue within a set. The former would be pretty advantageous for strength gains, where the latter doesn't seem to really drive things additionally. So that's kind of the elevator pitch for kind of how we kind of arrived on that conclusion to kind of start asking questions, I think, is more so than anything kind of what we did. And since have done some more kind of formal analyses to kind of investigate that further. And that would be kind of the general pitch there. I don't know if I missed anything or if I completely went off tangent from what you guys were wanting to chat about.
Well, I think you moved pretty fast through a point that I want to give you a chance to underline, and we're probably going to come back to it throughout this conversation a little bit, but just the point you made about, like, at a given weight, more reps doesn't seem to produce the outcomes necessary. So like it's tied really closely to the load on the bar, but it's not tied particularly closely to the proximity to failure for strength specifically. And correct me if I'm wrong, everybody talks about hypertrophy and they start talking about number of sets approaching failure. So we're saying that the way you would train for strength is focusing not on the approaching failure piece, but on the load on the bar. And then the way you would train for hypertrophy is on the approaching failure piece. Correct?
Bingo. Yep.
Okay. So I do also want to back up. We've established that Drew is Dead at Different Stinks' biggest fan, but not all of us are intimately aware of everything you guys are working on. So I kind of want to give you just a chance to explain, like, why did data-driven strength come into existence? What's your mission with that platform? Like, what message are you trying to get out?
I mean, we just got into kind of this area because I think we like lifting weights. Like, it's as simple as that. We like to say that powerlifting kind of found us as opposed to us particularly seeking out powerlifting. The next thing you know, we're each coaching a bunch of powerlifters, and then it's like, oh, hey, I want to win a national championship. Can you coach me? That sort of thing. And we're like, oh yeah, let's do it. And you know, the next thing you know, we've been coaching powerlifters for what, going on like 5 or 6 years now at this point. But a good amount of our time is also spent on the academic side, researching, doing, you know, in the trenches research, actual training studies, reporting the outcomes, contributing to the scientific process. And then data-driven strength allows us to communicate some of our work, but you know, one lab can only do so much. So our goal is to kind of communicate the general consensus, and particularly our understanding of the consensus of the research for strength and hypertrophy outcomes, which is a tall task in and of itself, because these things are tricky. And you know, when you first get into research, how you think about research and how you interpret it is a lot different than when you've been in the lab for, you know, like we've been in the lab for 4 or 5 years at this point. You know, the way you think about things, the way you interpret things, the limitations you address, et cetera, hopefully give us a decent perspective to communicate that research. And then also, you know, provide products and services that help people directly put that into practice. So that's the high level goal, right? Is to push the field forward in multiple ways, which is, you know, whether that's through actual original research, or that's through, you know, helping people put into practice, or, you know, communicating it to an audience of 2 or 3 people that tune into the podcast.
I know how you feel with that. I'm pretty sure my mom is the one who listens to this podcast, and that's about it. So shout out, Mom. I want to ask you guys, because I think, I mean, when I came across your work, and this might have just been my interpretation of it given where I was working at the time, but like, maybe controversial is a strong word, but certainly different, especially when we think about like low RPE. And traditionally people are saying, work till failure, load it up heavy, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Did you guys get any kind of criticism, or did anybody push back on some of the things that you guys were putting out, and what did that look like?
Let me jump in here, and then I'll kick it to Zach. This frustrates me a little bit, because the answer to your question, Drew, is yes, absolutely. We got a lot of pushback with kind of this initial framework we talked about that Zach explained, which again, in short, is that, hey, load on the bar, percentage of 1RM seems to be the main driver of strength outcomes, not necessarily the number of reps performed in that set, right? Because of force production, right? If you have a given load on the bar, that first rep is going to be the highest force production. That's kind of our working model, right? That intraset fatigue, that fatigue you accumulate within the set, if anything, is counterproductive for strength. Probably mm-hmm. closer to neutral, but arguably counterproductive, at least to a small degree. That's really all we said, right? But a lot of people like to take that and run with it. Oh, so you're saying to do 30% power days for powerlifting, right? And a lot of people kind of hear what they want to hear and just want to get pissed off because they want to get pissed off. So the mm-hmm. answer is yes, we did get, I'd say, a good amount of pushback. I mean, from more reasonable people, it's healthy pushback, healthy discussion, that sort of thing. But the funny thing is now in 2023, right? Maybe I'd say like 2020 or so is when we, I'd say, got some sort of traction with, you know, an audience to some degree. And, you know, we're able to kind of communicate that. We got a lot of pushback now, 3-ish years later. All of a sudden, everyone explains it in the same way that we do, kind of in our sphere. And they're like, oh, yeah, we've known this all along. It makes perfect sense. So that's me airing a little bit of frustration with how people think about this. But yeah, I'd say we brought a slightly different perspective. And, you know, for better or worse, I think it's kind of caught on at this point now.
Well, and I was going to say, because, you know, again, I don't remember exactly when I came across you guys in the first place, certainly a number of years ago. And then all of a sudden, it seems like relatively recently, certainly there's a lot more conversation around RPE / autoregulation. We'll just cage all those as one thing. But then even this idea of backing away from the idea of training to failure. And I think, you know, we'll get into some of this a little bit later, but when we think about it, you talked about having less intraset fatigue as being, you know, maybe a neutral factor. But when you're dealing with athletes that have to include elements of endurance, elements of work, I mean, we're a tactical athlete podcast here, and we talked about this a little bit before we hit record, like all of a sudden, if you can get coaches to change their viewpoint on what it means to execute resistance training and where the, you know, quote unquote minimal effective dose might be, if you can open up more training currency to put into other places, I mean, that's huge. And so, I mean, I would applaud you guys for having to deal with that criticism early on, because man, if there's a community of just like entrenched old school dudes that don't like to think outside the box, it's powerlifters. And no offense to powerlifters, cause I'm going to get a lot of grief for that.
Yeah, no, I think, we don't often get to talk about this specific application of it, but actually the way that I taught the kind of concept of intraset fatigue a little bit more broadly for one of the courses that I actually teach is kind of this funnel. And so there's kind of multiple things that kind of go into this funnel. You know, when we're talking to powerlifters, essentially all we're talking about is resistance training and specifically like volume and proximity to failure as two of the biggest buckets really. But when you kind of open that up a little bit more to kind of broader exercise in general, kind of this total amount of intraset fatigue that you accumulate is going to encompass more things. And one of the main things you just talked about is endurance training. So kind of putting endurance training into that kind of funnel of things that we're accumulating intraset fatigue for, that is from my reading of the literature, I think that if any population is even going to benefit even more from, you know, limiting intraset fatigue accumulation for their kind of strength work, it would people be undergoing concurrent training. And so I would even hammer home on that even more than kind of the general person, like a powerlifter, for example, where they have maybe a little bit more of that capacity to give. Whereas people that are performing a good amount of concurrent training, basically staying even shyer from that accumulation mm-hmm. of excessive intraset fatigue from their resistance training, and maybe save that for their endurance training might be even a better idea. So I think that's an interesting application we don't get to often talk about. But yeah, that's definitely an important consideration. I think when you kind of just think about that, just conceptually it makes sense, right? Like, I don't want to just absolutely dog myself in the gym and then have to go, you know, do my high performance running right after that to try to maintain both adaptations. You're basically trying to find the most specific and efficacious dose that I can deliver in kind of both departments to continue marching forward with kind of the adaptations in totality, and obviously individualization there, depending on what an individual needs to kind of maximize what they're looking for. But as a general concept, yeah, I think that applies even more so in the case of the population that we're talking about here, where we have kind of multiple sources. And even if you layer onto that, not only formal endurance training, but maybe also some sort of skills application where you're in the field doing additional sorts of training, that's going to be additional time on your feet, additional time kind of moving around, doing stuff like that. I think it probably is just going to mitigate that even more in comparison to a powerlifter who's taking 10-minute rest intervals and has a 9-to-5. No shade there, but that's just a kind of polarized example to the kind of two extremes.
For sure.
Well, you guys mentioned before we hit record that you don't have a ton of experience working with tactical professionals or this whole space in general. And I think there's some irony here because we're talking right now about like managing unnecessary fatigue and saving adaptation currency for other things. But if you've ever seen how like the military historically trains or like what traditional military physical training looks like, it is 100% oriented on producing the maximal amount of fatigue possible. Like
It's not good.
I have been in a formation of people that did 1,000 consecutive overhead arm claps, like just specifically to suffer and fatigue as much as possible. Like, I've seen Murph is everybody's favorite thing in the whole military. People love to do it all the time. It's all about, like, I talk to people all the time, like a normal PT week, if they like wrote it out on a calendar, would be Monday, Wednesday, Friday run, like Thursday ruck, and Tuesday muscle failure. It doesn't say anything more specific than muscle failure. We're just going to like do stuff until you can't anymore. And it's like what you're proposing is essentially the opposite of that. And I think it's fascinating.
Yeah. I think there's multiple ways to go about the training process. Right. And I think it's important to probably address a bias or at least a framework that we use. And that's to be as precise as possible with the adaptation we're shooting for. So for a powerlifter, for example, we would prefer to use like a sniper approach or a more precise approach with each set that's being done, right? So like, hey, this set right here, the goal is to get you better at, you know, something close to a third attempt on the powerlifting platform, right? Okay, let's optimize it around that goal. All right, now you've done your sets of low bar back squat, for example, for a powerlifter. Let's move on to something less specific, but it's going to grow your quads a little bit more efficiently, right? So that very precise and efficient approach, I guess to give a little bit of props to the other side of things, when there are a lot of additional goals, I think there can be at least some degree of, like it might be helpful to take more of a shotgun approach at times because it might be more efficient if there are so many training goals, right? For example, you might not have time to do low fatigue training just for strength, higher intercept fatigue, very isolation type work for hypertrophy. Also do maybe some sort of power training, endurance training, and then something to kind of exhibit some quote unquote mental toughness, right? Things might get a little bit tricky there from a practicality and from a time standpoint. So, and I find myself doing this a lot in practice with people that are particularly time, you know, constricted by time. But yeah, I mean, it's not going to look like overhead claps or whatever you said for by 1,000 at 10. But I think that's worth considering just to kind of make sure people don't over apply this concept. Is like, you kind of need to keep in mind all the outcomes you need to get within a certain training week, right? And make compromises where necessary, if that makes sense.
The other thing I was going to mention real quick that makes us maybe a little bit more challenging in this case too is, you know, powerlifting is simple from the standpoint of the outcome and adaptation of interest is very easy to identify. Whereas in this case, we kind of have a mix of, it's hard to understand what the key performance indicator is for these populations, I guess ultimately is what I was trying to get at. You have some adaptations that are associated with strength, some adaptations that are associated with power, some that are associated with muscular endurance, all of which have different recommendations in terms of proximity to failure. So it goes along with what Josh is saying in the sense that if somebody could show me data to say someone is a better individual in terms of whatever task you're performing in the military based on their amount of body weight pushups they could do, that would probably change the way that I prescribe the resistance training versus the key performance indicator and relevant to their kind of their task or their occupation in the military is maybe a 1RM back squat. I would train them differently based on whatever the actual key performance indicator is that I just don't have the domain knowledge to understand what that is. That would change the prescription of proximity to failure ultimately. So I think that's important to realize too. For example, if it is more kind of muscular endurance oriented, that basically flips the recommendation ultimately in the sense that intercept fatigue in a way is kind of the stimulus that you're going after. So if it's strength oriented, then obviously we kind of goes with everything we just said, power oriented, even more so in the low intercept fatigue direction. But if it is that muscular endurance component, there's kind of two components and it kind of depends what types of endurance you're talking about. You have absolute muscular endurance or you have relative muscular endurance. Absolute would be like how many repetitions can I do with my body mass, which basically as you get stronger, we're maintaining our body mass, but that becomes a lower percentage of our kind of maximal strength. So in that case, you're going to want to improve your maximal strength. So you're going to have some of the stuff we already talked about, but you're also going to want to try to improve your kind of endurance oriented capacities. You'll probably have some high intercept fatigue training for that to kind of improve both sides of the absolute muscular endurance spectrum there. But if you're training for purely relative muscular endurance, which basically means I want to see how many repetitions I can perform with a given percentage of my 1RM. So let's say 80% of my 1RM. So as I get stronger, the load that I'm using to test that would increase. Then you're probably almost entirely kind of dedicating that to towards the high intercept fatigue oriented stuff because the increase in maximal strength in that case isn't actually improving that. You want to get the kind of the true endurance adaptations, if you will. So that additional layer in this context does make things a little bit more challenging and does lend even more credence to kind of what Josh is saying in the sense that I have a hard time believing there is cohesive data in the military to have, you know what, if you can do a body weight wall sit for more than 3 minutes, you're going to be excellent at your occupation. I'm assuming that data doesn't exist and there's probably nothing that's super clean in terms of key performance indicators. So then you just kind of have to go with, principles and obviously go with your guys' domain knowledge and experience ultimately to kind of contrive that and ultimately see what the best kind of approach is to mix all those different kind of things in terms of what the adaptations of interest are.
The concept you're circling around there, and this is more of just like a comment for the audience if they want to go dive into a rabbit hole, but I can't remember whose book it was. I read it a couple of years ago, but they talk about like wicked versus kind learning environments. And basically what we're saying here is that powerlifting is a pretty kind learning environment. You can try something and then pretty quickly get feedback on did that thing work versus training tactical professionals is a pretty wicked learning environment. You're never really going to get direct feedback on whether the thing you did worked or not because there's so many confounding variables and you don't know what the quote unquote competition is going to look like. There's not a lot of direct feedback to confirm or deny hypotheses about what protocol is appropriate for this population.
Is that from range?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. I think that's a really good way to describe, I think, what exactly Zach and I were circling around, right? Powerlifting, we have these pretty estimated 1 rep max graphs to be able to get a pretty good idea of how strong someone is every single week, right? And is that perfect? No. But in the grand scheme of strength and conditioning, it's really, really good. And sometimes I think as powerlifting coaches, we take that for granted. We have a really good metric of the outcome of interest almost every single week, and it's pretty dang accurate, right? And even if it's not super accurate, it's at least consistently inaccurate, right? And that's not the case for most strength and conditioning professionals, right? So yeah, sucks to be you guys.
Well, I want to, so, I mean, that brings up, and I'm jumping ahead here a little bit, but one of the articles you guys wrote relatively recently is, you know, I think it's how hard are we training? And it was additional considerations for reps in reserve. And you get into that, you guys call it the psychobiological model. We've had folks on here that have talked about something very similar, talking about kind versus wicked and how this pertains to training. you would think that, yeah, sure, with powerlifting, we have these three things and we can chart it on a graph. And one of the things that we've, I think, maybe controversially brought up on here a couple of times, John Kiley comes to mind as a guest we had on, but when you really factor in the human component of training, periodization, planning, whatever you want to call it, it can get really messy. So I'd be curious to hear what you guys is, with as much time as you spent with the research, with as much time as you've spent training athletes, focusing on powerlifting, how does that piece of it, that human element, factor into reps in reserve, RPE, autoregulation, whatever you want to call it? And how do you account for that in a lot of these models that you guys put together?
I'll kind of give an example of why the research is not particularly helpful. Like, we, our lab has done a good amount of work in a body of research called repetitions and reserve rating accuracy. So that's basically the same thing as RPE rating accuracy. How accurate are people in terms of estimating how close they are to failure? Mm-hmm. And basically what we found, at least from our most recent paper, is that as long as they're trying to rate something pretty close to failure, people are really good at it. Which I think surprises a good amount of people. However, you need to take a step back and think about that context, right? You have me, Zach, and probably a couple of additional investigators in the lab with their preferred music, full blast. And, you know, there's maybe some social pressure to some degree, right? They want to try to be as accurate as possible. And it's just like a really, really good training environment. I'm sometimes jealous of our research participants with the training environment that we're able to provide. And they nail it and they do really good. Are they perfect? No, but the accuracy is almost strikingly good. And basically what we found from our most recent RER accuracy paper is that across a training program, the research question was, did they get better over time? But they were so good to start, there was really no way to improve, is basically what we found. But when you kind of take a step back and it's like, okay, that's a short-term training study with, you know, preferred music, you know, really nice social environment, and just kind of good vibes in the lab, because, you know, we want people to enjoy coming to their training sessions. I mean, you take a step back and you know, you roll up to the gym by yourself and it's been a long day at work, and maybe there's some mental fatigue, maybe there's additional stressors that are on your mind. I think that can kind of change our perception of effort. And I think that's something I've kind of landed on, at least in my own experience and my interpretation of a lot of other research as well, is that how hard we think we're training is probably the biggest thing that influences inaccuracy in terms of our ability to rate RPE. So it's not necessarily that we're bad at it, or that we don't know how to train to failure, things like that, but more so some of these psychological factors that might hold us back or make the task at hand seem more difficult than it actually is. Now, okay, you take that concept and you say, what do we do with it in practice? And I'm not totally sure, because on one hand, that could be an indication that additional stress, for example, could be an indication you need to pull back a little bit, or it could be an indication that, you know, you need to kind of look past those things and try to nail it the best you can. But I think the, you know, training environment, presence of spotters, additional stressors, all of these things are going to influence how someone chooses to autoregulate in the gym if you're using a system like RPE. So I'm not sure if there's any threads you want to pull on there, or if that's kind of getting at what you guys were thinking.
Well, I know, I mean, sort of, I guess we'll call it chapter two of this discussion. I do want to get into conversation around how you can take that and some of the stuff you guys have put out with your Infinity program, for example. I'd call it individualization at an industrial scale. I think there's some threads to pull there, but I do want to back up, because before we go there, I've heard this a couple of times when I've followed you guys' work just from different podcasts and whatever, this idea of not bashing low RPE, but people see that concept and they just assume, okay, we just train easy all the time. And that's not what you guys are saying. And one of the things you mentioned in the guide that you put out on your website, which we'll include in the show notes for folks, but specific to hypertrophy, the example that you use, I think, is 3x8 at 2 reps in reserve versus 6x4 at 6 reps in reserve, and kind of the different it's kind of saying the same thing, but you're coming at it from two different ways. And the implications for those two different setups are valuable for all the reasons that we've already talked about, you know, less fatigue, et cetera, et cetera. Can you guys hit that and just clear up any misconceptions people might have when they think low RPE, I'm training easy all the time, how do I get any better?
Sure. Yeah. So I think the thinking there is like, it makes sense. It makes sense why people kind of initially has like a little bit of a weird reaction to it. I think the piece of that that ultimately fits everything together from like an experience standpoint is we're missing one kind of hidden premise here that is kind of an additional variable to intensity. And that would be kind of the concentric effort that you're using. And I think that kind of helps kind of fit some of this low RP stuff together. So that kind of the force model that we outlined earlier only works if you're trying as hard as you possibly can on literally every single rep. If you're deliberately slowing down the reps, the kind of the force of those repetitions can be considerably different than what in theory, what it should be. So the first thing to say is, you know, when we're talking about this low RP stuff, for the most part, we're talking somewhere in the 70 to 85% of 1RM range. So while that can be pretty light if you're in the lower end of that range, for the most part, those are still like reasonable training weights. Even if you take that for like one rep, you know, it still feels like something's on the bar. And this is where that first confusion can kind of, you know, people hear low RPE training. And like Josh said earlier, they immediately think throwing around power training weights where I can jump off the ground with a barbell, things like that. We're basically saying for strength, you essentially kind of the principle based approach there is we're going to try to train with as heavy a loads as possible, as often as possible, and then work things back from there based on individual constraints, leverages, tolerances, et cetera. So you're kind of starting from the base physiological principle of like, what's the most specific way to train? And then you're going to work back from there to kind of layer on these additional constraints. And so when we say low RPE, it's low RPE relative to the load that you're lifting. It could be that low RPE for, you know, a set at 85% of 1RM is two reps at a 7 RPE, right? Like that could be, you know, low RPE to some, whereas, you know, you hear three reps in reserve, that's like a pretty standard recommendation for hypertrophy that I don't think people would call low RPE necessarily. So low RPE is contextual to the load that you're actually lifting. And all we're saying is that you're just trying to eliminate some of that extra set fatigue. So if you've done this and experienced it, I think the piece there is when you're training with absolute max concentric effort and you're training, you know, multiple sets with that and also doing other exposures to heavy loads throughout the week, accumulating a good amount of volume, et cetera, kind of doing all the things that we recommend as opposed to just saying the low RPE part, I think people can realize that it's still hard training. I've taken this to the extreme in my own training. So when I was kind of taking my journey to squat 500, we were just starting to write about this stuff. So I was training with 32 back off singles with 70%. And that was some of the most grueling mental training I've ever done. So I would do those with, you know, every 30 seconds on 30 seconds, kind of EMOM style, but 30 second rest intervals, and just had like a clock in front of me. And I literally would do that for, you know, an extended period of time. And that is low RPE training, but I'm telling you right now, if you've ever done it in every single one of those reps in an isolated fashion, trying to move it as fast as you physically can, the force you're producing is like, it's going to be really high. And that's ultimately what's going to map onto the actual perception of effort. So it depends what you mean by, is this hard training? Like, is this one rep in reserve? If that's the metric by which you're relating to hard training, I guess no. But if you're talking about the experience of which you feel with the training, I would generally say it's probably a little bit higher than you think. Now, of course, we still think there's benefits from a fatigue perspective, all that kind of stuff. But I guess I'm just fighting the dichotomy of that. It feels like a walk in the park and you walk out of the gym fresh as a daisy. That's definitely not my experience. So hopefully
32 singles.
It was brutal.
How did you arrive?
I don't know if I needed that many.
How did you arrive at the number 32?
So I think I was doing, way that I got there, I think I did one block where I was doing four sets of eight, and then I did another block where I was doing eight sets of four. And then I was like, well, you know, we wrote the article. I have to take this to its logical endpoint. So then I decided I was going to give 32 singles a shot. I did end up squatting 500. I haven't touched it since, and I've also not done 32 singles since. So maybe that is the magic sauce.
There you go. For all the listeners, 32 singles every 30 seconds.
Well, so I did this before. I'm gonna kind of do it again. This isn't really a question as much as it is in like an early conversation that I had with Drew about the work you guys were doing. I was trying to get it to make sense in a way he helped explain it for me that worked for me. And you guys can tell me whether this is like along the right lines or not. Could be all over the place. I don't know. But it helped things click for me when he started talking about like the reason weights move slow. Like the reason a one rep max moves slow is not the same reason the last rep of a long set moves slow. And like the other layer of that that people aren't thinking about is that if you're moving the same weight for a bunch of reps and it starts to slow down, that means each progressive rep you are putting less force into the bar. So you're like, that made it click for me a lot, and you guys are nodding. So hopefully I'm along the right lines here, but yeah. I just think that was a way to like lay it out that starts to make sense to people. Like the bar slowing down doesn't just mean you're working hard. It also means you're just producing less force.
Yeah. Nailed it. One thing we've kind of changed our mind on is how much that matters. So when you do multiple reps in a set, right, and you get closer and closer to failure, force production decreases and the reps kind of become disproportionately fatiguing. Mm-hmm. And the force production I think is important, but I think the latter is probably more important. I would say in the past we probably took that force production and ran with it a little bit too much. I think there's definitely something there, but I think the fatigue matters a little bit more. Reason being is we recently, and Zach led this project, we recently preprinted a meta-analysis. And part of that meta-analysis was a meta-regression looking at basically the relationship between strength outcomes from a training program and the average reps in reserve that the group trained at. And I think maybe in 2020, we would have guessed that you kind of see it essentially strength gains decrease as you get closer to failure as a result of that decreased force production. But what you see is it's pretty flat, right? So essentially there's no relationship between reps in reserve and strength outcomes, right? Again, and it's because all the studies that went into that were load equated. So again, load seems to be driving what's going on as opposed to the RPE or the RIR. Now, as you get closer to failure, it drops off, the strength gains drop off a little bit, but that's probably the disproportionate fatigue that's going on as you get to like one RIR, zero RIR, that sort of thing. So I think that force production thing matters a lot, but it might matter more for something like speed or power, for example. I think it has applications for strength, but really I think the main thing we focus on with it now is that fatigue management side of the equation.
Yeah, I think I'm going to add a few extra pieces of contents. Oh, geez, context there, man. I was slurring my words. I swear I'm sober. the one thing I will say is that I think the thing that gets lost in the literature that we really don't have a ton of good comparisons on this with is that in practice, we're thinking about this is predominantly kind of a optimization game that is going to happen after we've done some sort of indicator set. And so the reason you're going to select a proximity to failure for those sets would be different if you had to select a proximity to failure for every single set across the board. So one thing, like Josh said, when we were kind of initially thinking about this versus kind of how we communicate this now, if you were to do a training program where the load is equated and one group is training very close to failure, let's say at 9 RPE, the other group's training, in a model where they match all the repetitions, but they kind of do it in the lower intercept fatigue fashion. Initially kind of first genesis of this idea, oh, no question, low RPE group wins, they're going to have greater strength gains, no second thoughts about that. The problem is now if you are not allowing the low RPE group to also get exposures to absolute low velocities, there's certain things that are unaccounted for now because you're not just worried about the differences in like the neuromuscular adaptations associated with that fatigue. This group that's training closer to failure gets to know what it feels like when their background's on a squat. They get to know what it feels like to be nervous on a repetition they're not sure they're going to get. They get to know what it feels like to move a bar really, really slow, and all the skill associated adaptations and some probably some neuromuscular stuff as well associated with doing those things that kind of mimic a 1RM, just not in the most specific way you could do them. So if both groups were to perform some sort of indicator set that is, you know, like a heavy single, let's say, and then they go on to do their volume work, now that kind of those back off sets are for a different purpose at this point. We've had our kind of exposure to the task that we're trying to improve, and now we're kind of focusing on something different. I think that changes the calculus a little bit, which isn't what we see normally in the research. So the research is going to kind of paint that first example where I think potentially there could be a little bit of an advantage to the conditions training closer to failure where you kind of balance things. And that's what we talked about in the discussion of that meta-analysis Josh was speaking about, of kind of these contrasting advantages and disadvantages of training close and farther from failure for strength. Whereas if I'm programming for somebody in the real world, I would say I do kind of favor that kind of force production line of thinking for that reason, because we do kind of take that other part out of the equation, because we do have these indicator sets that give us all the exposures that those really close to failure sets would give us, but we do so in a way more specific fashion with considerably less fatigue. And then and as far as the downsides that we see, the interesting thing here is in the analysis that we did, the slope of the relationship was relatively flat in terms of the kind of the overall effect, or the kind of the main effect, which would be the most kind of basic representation of it. But as loads decreased, the kind of advantage from training farther from failure kind of seemed to increase. And that potentially could be because the amount of intraset fatigue that you can accumulate with lower loads is just way greater. If I'm training with 80% of 1RM, kind of you can think about it this way. It's not the exact same thing, but kind of the amount of burn that you can accumulate in a set with like a 80 to 85% of 1RM versus a set with 30% of 1RM is completely different. And so the negative cost, or the kind of the total intraset fatigue that you can accumulate with those lower loads, is substantially greater. So I think the cost there is also kind of depending on the load that you're using. The heavier load you go, basically that's where the high RP no longer is a bad thing, because it's load mediated the further heavy that you go. But the farther lower that you go, the more kind of intraset fatigue dominant that change in RPE is. And so the cost is probably going to be a little bit more negative in those cases. So those are just a few things I wanted to hit on there too.
No, I think that it makes a lot of sense. And I think, I mean, can you just briefly hit on that indicator set? Because I think practically speaking, that becomes really, really important for exactly the reason you guys said. But just again, from my experience with this concept, a lot of coaches miss that point, that, you know, double at RPE 8 or whatever, and then you have your drop-offs. Can you just hit on that briefly?
Yeah. So if you're taking the kind of the force production model to its like logical endpoint, what in reality, what you should be starting with is, I'm going to do 10 singles at 100% of 1RM, or I'm going to do 10 maxes, because a single at 100% of 1RM is going to be the highest load, and it's going to be the lowest intraset fatigue because it's one repetition. So that's going to be kind of where we start. And so obviously for anybody that's played around with maxing or anything, tolerating a meaningful amount of training volume in that way is essentially impossible. You know, you're going to be there for 8 hours to try to get a meaningful number of repetitions done with 100% 1RM. So, you know, you kind of make the logistical choice to say, let's do some sort of heavy work and some sort of work that's kind of dedicated towards volume. And so the indicator set is kind of the thing you're talking about. And it's kind of got it's got a ton of different uses. That's been, you know, by no means our ideas. It's just that it kind of fits into this concept well. You can use it to mark progress, like Josh was talking about, kind of create an estimated 1RM, which basically gives us a finger on the pulse of something that we care about that we can easily measure and make changes based upon week after week. It's going to allow us to auto-regulate training loads on that given day. So by having kind of a fixed metric that we're going after, we can see how our performance is on that day. And then we can make the prescriptions relative to our capacity on a given session. So that's really nice. And then also from like the actual adaptation standpoint that we're concerned with here, it gives us an exposure to a very high force set, essentially as high force as you can tolerate, with essentially zero intracept fatigue if you're doing a single or like a double, very, very, very little. So it's basically just going to give us a very, very specific exposure to the task that we're trying to actually improve, to which then we go to the volume work where we're basically trying to compromise as little as possible to get what we need to get done in the volume work. So for some people on bench press, like for me, I can tolerate pretty high loads essentially all the time. My shoulders don't seem to get bothered. My pecs don't really seem to get bothered. So my bench training, to kind of stick to kind of the physiological principle, looks like a lot of heavy singles at like a 9 RP, which is like 96% of my 1 RM. And then I'll do, you know, sets at like 85% of my 1 RM as my back off. So my low RP work in this case are like doubles at a 7 to 8 RP. So it's really not that low RP in that case, but it is low intracept fatigue for that load. Whereas, you know, Josh, he has a little bit different bench training where I think he's a little bit more submaximal than me for a couple of different reasons, but the principles there are all the same. You get, you know, an exposure or some sort of indicator set that's going to give you the most specific kind of dose of that maximal strength or high force exposure. And then we move over to the kind of the volume work where we're basically trying to compromise on that principle as little as possible to accumulate some work, get some additional practice, get some hypertrophy, although that's probably not the most efficient way to do it. You're still going to get a really solid stimulus if the load is heavy enough, and kind of try to knock some of those other birds out.
Well, I think, I mean, it's an important point and a thread that I want to pull on a little bit here, because I remember first getting into these concepts, and Bondarchuk is a coach that comes to mind, tracking hammer throws. And he would have guys throw the hammer every day and track distances. And that's how you would determine if you were done with that phase of training or not, you know, blah, 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 blah. The challenge for resistance training is what is the proxy for the hammer throw? What are we tracking? And so one of the things we talk about here a lot, like I mentioned, is autoregulation. And that can be a challenge for some coaches to wrap their heads around, because when you take away this idea of predicting the future and saying that 6 Tuesdays from now, you're going to do 3 sets of 5 at 85%. The first question they ask is, what tools do I have in my toolbox to track progress? Like, what are the indicators in the program that I can use to say, is this athlete ready to shift gears or not? And the indicator sets, in my experience, I've relied pretty heavily on estimated 1 rep max. There's calculators you can use for all the coaches out there to track that. And when the athlete's estimated 1 rep max deviates from what you think it should be, it's kind of a signal to tweak the program. And so it becomes a really important tool to stay away from too much fatigue, to stay away from the injury risk, and really get at a lot of the things that I think Alex and I preach on, which is like, you know, the reverse causality of progressive overload and all these different like nerdy phrases that we throw out there. And the reason why I wanted to hit on that indicator set piece a little bit more is because it's incredibly important when we go to track athlete progress over time. I don't know if you guys had any more thoughts on that.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head. Like, the indicator set is easy for powerlifting, but I'm sure there's solutions for the tactical, you know, strength conditioning coach. Maybe it's multiple indicator sets. Maybe it's a session specific one, something like that. I'm not going to, you know, spitball ideas, because I wouldn't want anyone to take them too seriously, because it's not something that I've thought much about or looked into autoregulation of team sport athletes, things like that. Not really our area, but you can basically anchor the rest of the session to that, right? Mm-hmm. So a very simple approach would be work up to a single that you think is, you know, 2 reps in reserve. Okay, now just drop it 20% and do some sets of 5. Drop the load 20% and do sets of 5. If you feel terrible that day, right? That single at 2 reps in reserve is going to be lighter. So now your back offs are also lighter. But if you're feeling good, you're going to, you know, take another jump or two for that single with 2 reps in reserve, and now your back offs are also heavier. So you're kind of, autoregulation at its core is matching the training stress to the performance on the day. And performance is there's a lot of things that go into performance, right? And you can't necessarily predict it. Like you said, you don't know how strong you're going to be in 6 weeks, let alone session 2 compared to session 3 of the week. And having tools to be able to make adjustments on the fly in a very intuitive way, I think is, I would have a hard time coaching anyone without those tools is how I'll put it.
Yeah. And I mean, this segues nicely into where I think we want to touch on next, which, I mean, shout out to you guys, the Infinity programs that you guys have up on the website. Just one thing I wanted to tease out was a challenge that we hear all the time is that the coaches that we work with oftentimes deal with hundreds, if not thousands, of athletes. And so I think, like you mentioned, fundamentally, they understand catering to the needs of the athlete on any given day. It makes sense. And if it was just me and one athlete, me and two athletes, great. I could have that level of clarity with the programming. But when you roll that out to hundreds and hundreds of people, how do you introduce that individualized element? And I think you guys have done it in a really creative way. I just have no clue how it works in terms of the back end and the data that you have feeding into your spreadsheet. So can you guys touch on what that looks like and how you factored the individualization component into sort of the industrialization of programming, if you will?
This is tricky.
You're on the spot.
I'll give it my best shot, because you're right. It's kind of hard to explain it, like, just from ground zero, if you will, because
without giving away the secret sauce.
No. I honestly, like, you can make the exact same thing. I don't think many people will last trying to just, like, the amount of hours that I'll put it this way. Before we launched it, I was, like, very strongly burnt out for, like, probably 6 weeks. In hindsight, we probably should have released that a little bit later, but we got it done. Anyway, this is the third version of this system. And, you know, over time, it's gotten more and more complex, and we've hired more people for each step of the process. So some of the exact things that go into it, we know generally, but, you know, someone more skilled than us actually made the actual system itself. But at its core, it's essentially a system that uses thousands and thousands of variables to create a program. And those variables inform the actual training prescription. Okay. So it informs logistical things such as how many days per week the individual can train, the number of times per week in a powerlifting context that they want to bench press, the number of times per week that they want to squat. If they have prior experiences with these sorts of things, a lot of people come to us, they're like, yeah, benching twice a week, my bench tanks. But once I bench 4 or 5 times a week, things really fly. Okay, they can kind of feed that information to the system. Or if not, that's cool too, based on, you know, things like training status. We ask some questions regarding, like, the style of bench press that they use, and body weight as well can kind of inform the starting point, just based on largely our experience can kind of inform the starting point for that system or for that individual. And it also is very nitty-gritty things, right? Like, you know, do you have any particular reason to enjoy this sort of progression scheme in terms of how the training changes week to week for a top set, right? Like, do you do well when, you know, things increase pretty linearly in terms of the top set RP throughout a block? Or are you someone that, you know, might be a little bit sensitive to that sort of approach and prefers a more static approach, right? So kind of high level things, days per week, all the way down to nitty-gritty progression approach of your bench press training over a 5 week block, that sort of thing. And those variables inform the program, but what informs the variables? Well, that's essentially a custom quiz that we've built that asks people questions that we think is relevant. And we basically have the system that's okay, quiz informs variables, variables informs program, right? And let's say someone is 3 weeks into their program, something's not working out. Okay, back to the quiz. Create new variables, get a new program. Or, you know, you finish that program. Maybe it's an 8 week program. Maybe it's a 14 week program. Those are all things that we have variations of as well. And then you can also take a different path in that quiz. And now you are basically giving feedback on the variables that you just created. So everyone essentially in the back end has a profile that informs their program design. Now, how realistic is that to build? Honestly, I mean, we did it and we're also, you know, full-time students. So it's possible, but it's also very difficult. And the only solution to my knowledge is a custom built sort of thing, like what we did, or to hire a developer, a team of developers to make a mobile app to create a system like this. And there's a lot of decisions that go into it. it's not all sunshine and rainbows. For example, you change your mind about a training thing six months later, there can be a lot of steps to kind of unfold that within the system, right? So there's kind of a lag period as well. I would love for someone to create some sort of platform where, you know, coaches can go in and kind of toggle things that they believe to be true or that are relevant to their population, or the KPIs that are relevant to this athlete or this group of athletes for someone that's managing hundreds of individuals. But that from a high level is what we're doing, is we're individualizing training in an iterative and systematic way based on the outcome of interest. And in our case, that's largely performance outcomes. So mm-hmm. hypertrophy oriented person doesn't care about powerlifting. We're going to look at the performance over time for a specific muscle group, and that can inform, you know, any changes, if at all, for the next program. For a powerlifter, more straightforward, kind of based on strength progress. So you, again, from a high level, we just have, okay, what's the KPI? What went into any changes to that KPI? What feedback do they have? Okay, that informs the next program, essentially. That's from a high level, how we think about training and how we have attempted to build it into an automated process.
Mm-hmm. So I have, there are a few listeners on this podcast. They're going to be going crazy for the kind of stuff you're talking about in terms of like mm-hmm. being able to ingest that data and like automatically make decisions based
other
on
people's
it,
heads are going to be exploding.
Yeah, this is also true. Mine is a little bit, but I'll ask a question that I know some of them would ask, given all the stuff you just said. With the increasing accessibility of really robust AI type of platforms, do you see this kind of really changing the kind of stuff you're doing? Because what you're talking about is like you guys having to like, to a certain extent, manually program a lot of these decisions. And we're getting to a place where tools are available where you might be able to broaden it into more and more complex types of training, more and more complex goals. Do you see that on the horizon, or do you think that's farther off than it seems like it is?
I'm going to answer in 30 seconds, and it might be different than Zach's. And this is very relevant to Zach's dissertation, so he should take this one. But I think it might be further off than we think, specifically for strength conditioning. But Zach, I'll let you.
Yeah, it's tough. This is it just comes down to how confident are we in a lot of the ways we can acquire data that actually confirm somebody's individual responsiveness or not. I'll save me going on a soliloquy about how to actually do this and how complicated it is and all that kind of stuff. As Josh said, this is what my dissertation's about, and I've lost more sleep over thinking about this than I'd like. If anything, it has made me realize how little we know about individualization, and just open my eyes to how complicated solving that problem really is. And it's not as straightforward as I once thought. So ultimately, because of that, I do think the technology that could achieve a right answer will be readily available relatively soon. I don't think that's the barrier. If we knew the information that it needed to come to a correct answer, I think that we could do that. Like the actual technology barrier, I don't think is going to be the issue. I think it's going to be the domain knowledge associated with how can we confidently detect individual response variation. What does it mean to respond individually? What does it mean to have a favorable response to one condition versus the other? How are you making sure that that is not associated with sampling variation, sampling error, measurement error, all these sorts of things that get really complicated when you're talking about an N of one kind of case? Because in the case of resistance training, unlike in medicine or things like that, where we can repeat an intervention and kind of see the stability of an effect, there's always second, third, fourth order effects that occur in resistance training if we repeat a program. So there's, even in a philosophical nature of it, it's kind of impossible to really tease out what it means for somebody to respond individually in a true sense. So I'm probably steering away from this and steering to what I was writing about today. So I will try to circle back. But ultimately, yes, I think the technology will be coming relatively soon. I think you're going to see a ton of individualized training apps are going to be coming. A lot of them are probably going to deliver really, really solid programming. And I think the technological barrier is not going to be our issue. I think it's going to be getting robust data sets and understanding this from a very high level and from the research perspective to know what is the way we need to construct kind of sort of an assessment, or what is the key performance indicator going to look like. So just to kind of maybe give an example of just like comparing change in estimated 1RM from program A versus program B, that's probably not good enough is ultimately what I'm getting at. Is if I perform a high volume, close to failure training cycle versus a high volume, far from failure training cycle, and in this one I have a 10% increase and this one I have a 7% increase, or let's say even 5% increase, so double the gain in program A, that's probably not sufficient to say that that's actually something that's better, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of other things that can kind of go into that that make that determination a little bit foggier. And so when you're looking to build an AI system to ultimately feed training that is as a more favorable response for an individual, defining what that means gets really, really challenging really quickly. And so I think that's ultimately the barrier here is going to be us as the imperfect apes behind the dashboard of picking the button that we want to say, this is what I want you to optimize this training system for, because that's ultimately the gear that makes everything go. That's the difficult question. Whereas I think all the downstream implications, if you say, design me a training system that makes these modifications, which are going to be coaches intuition driven and modification driven, based on this outcome, that's not far away off at all. Like we said, ours is not a, you know, a super sleek iOS application by any means, but like under the hood, I think it's going to be what's going to continue to come out from its basic components and just continue to get optimized over time. Like those principles of how ours is designed is basically what I think everything is going to continue to be. It's just going to get continuously more optimized and utilize some of those language models and other things under the hood to make them more efficient and be able to scale even greater than what we have. So I think, long story short there, technology isn't far off, but the ultimate kind of kicking the ball down the hill to get us to that answer, that's the nice perfect training program that we're all after, I think is probably a little bit farther out than we want. But I will be excited to be proven wrong if that's the case. I would be excited to see somebody who designs an app that, you know, is able to figure out all the issues that I'm thinking of in my head and prove me wrong and give everybody really, really solid training for an affordable price and continuously move us in that direction. So that's my rant over.
So this is going to be like a little bit me talking to coaches who are listening, because I've heard some responses to that a bunch. And one of the most common responses is like, AI is going to take our jobs. Right. This is my chance to like get on a soapbox for a second, I guess. But I don't think there are a lot of coaches who think program design is the foundation of coaching, and that is what coaching is. And I think that's the part of coaching that's easy to study and easy to quantify and easy to put on PowerPoint slides and teach in classes and things like that. And I don't actually think it's the most critical part of coaching, especially as you get away for more elite athlete populations and get into like coaching gen pop for like more complicated goals and more complicated lifestyle factors and things like that. I think, yes, this might mean that like debates about different periodization models get less relevant, but I don't think they were as relevant as coaches act like they are to begin with. And maybe people are going to get mad at me for saying that. I don't know. But like when I click on like run workout on my Garmin, like this is new because I got a new watch recently, but it tells me what my recommended workout for that day is based on my training the last few days. It says you should do threshold stuff today, or you should do base building stuff today. And like, that doesn't remove the point of having coaching though. It just removes the X's and O's part that I would argue is probably not the more important part.
Well, the thing I would add to that, and maybe this is a soapbox, maybe we're just doing a soapbox round robin here, but like, the AI piece is interesting to me, given my day job and the environment that we're in. Again, this sort of industrialized human performance model that the military likes, because, and we've talked about this all the time, senior leaders like to think that human beings and Humvees are the same thing. And I can diagnose a human the same way I can diagnose a machine, And it just consists of a series of variables that if some scientist somewhere can throw into an algorithm, all of a sudden I have that perfect program. And so it's interesting to hear you guys being, you know, arguably at kind of the forefront of these discussions, recognize how far off we are from that. Because I think one of the challenges that we deal with in this space, and it might be true in collegiate and professional sport, I just don't have as much exposure to it, but the challenge is in having conversations about the human element of this and how hard it truly is to say, this is what you need to do today or tomorrow or the next day or weeks from now, months from now, years from now, whatever. It doesn't map the same way that a maintenance schedule for a tank might look, as an example. And so I think it's just, you know, we don't have to hang out here any longer, but it's just interesting to think about how truly complex that is and how it almost requires that we open up an entirely different set of discussions around, okay, what is it? What does the human element of this actually look like? Because it looks a lot different than a machine. And I'll step off my soapbox now.
I'll throw one out and then Josh,
yeah,
gets
a soapbox.
The holy grail, I think, and this is just like insight into tactical for you guys, I guess, but the holy grail is a brigade commander gets to look at a computer monitor, and on that monitor is a dashboard with 4,000 stick figure soldiers, and each one of them next to them has a percent ready number.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that, I just don't know if that exists. And like, there's a lot of companies saying that they can produce that, and I'm not sure.
Yeah, I can't necessarily speak directly to that, but my kind of daily experience might be at least semi-helpful for a listener too. And that's, you know, we're scientists and we're also coaches and we also develop these systems, right? And don't get me wrong, being a scientist makes me a better coach, and being a coach makes me a better scientist. Absolutely. However, the actual skills and the frame of mind I'm in when I'm designing our next training study versus when I'm programming for an athlete, completely different, right? Like the skills I'm using when I'm talking to humans are not my scientist skills, right? You know, you guys can probably relate that a lot of your time is spent with the practical things, right? And having the domain knowledge about like, okay, something's got to give here. What are we going to prioritize? Or how big of a deal is it that this individual lost a loved one recently and is going to, you know, miss a week of training before, you know, 7 weeks out from their powerlifting meet? Yeah, the research can be helpful there, for example, or the domain knowledge can be helpful there. But it's honestly kind of a small part of it, at least from a day-to-day perspective. Now, when you sit down to do that deep work of, you know, looking through their training log and determining what's worked well and make your best guess for what to do next for that individual. Yeah, I'm kind of thinking like a scientist, but when you're actually doing kind of the coaching itself, which is talking to the individual and collaborating with them, it's you don't have your scientist hat on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, and the last place I know that we wanted to go before we let you guys go, and we've gone all over the place, which I think is perfect, but we've had researchers on here and we've had coaches on here, and there seems to be a divide in some sense where folks in the lab, folks conducting research, and we'll call this sports science broadly, but strength and conditioning, I think more specifically, there's a bit of a disconnect between what coaches see on the ground and what they know works versus what gets published in a lot of your leading journals in this space. And I think you guys and folks in your network are at an interesting place because you seem to have a good understanding of like you mentioned, when to wear those different hats. And so maybe the question here that I'm after for you is for your average coach who reads the books, reads the blogs, gets on Instagram, finds the program, understands the X's and O's, but wants to become a little bit more exposed to research. Like, what does that journey look like? How do you recommend folks get involved in that? And what does that look like for you guys?
It's a tough one. I guess I'll start with what I think the utility of research is first. So, like you mentioned, there's always going to be that degree of in the trenches knowledge that's invaluable and is going to basically fill in the gaps where research can't tell us things to ultimately lead to the getting across the bridge to the actual decision that you're going to make for the athlete. Like Josh said, just as an easy example, if you're dealing with an athlete that just had their loved one pass away, that's just literally entirely experience driven on how to handle that situation in the context of getting them to prepare for a powerlifting meet. That's obviously research is never going to tell you that. So that's kind of an extreme example, but it illustrates the point nicely. Where I think research is useful is a few things. One, it gives us some, it kind of narrows our scope on things to focus on, I think is the first advantage. So like an example that I would utilize there is, you know, supplement research for let's say. So over the years research, and obviously the advantage of science is in limiting a lot of those confounding variables for people observing their own data on the ground. That's kind of the entire point. I can go on a longer rant on that if necessary, but that's why science is advantage in general. But to specifically in the context of strength conditioning, it allows us to narrow our scope to things that we're actually interested in and potentially make a difference. So all these supplements, let's say, that essentially have no effect or don't have a high probability of having an effect, we don't have to focus on those anymore. And the reason that becomes relevant is because we've just talked about for, you know, over an hour here, how difficult it is to identify a key performance indicator. And that's how you make true quote unquote evidence-based decisions on the individual level, is having something that you're using to say whether the intervention you're using is successful or not. And that sounds like a simple process, but it's really not, particularly in the context that you're talking about. So if we can utilize some sort of highly controlled environment where we can ultimately narrow our focus on a few things that have a higher probability of being things that we can actually focus on and get a good amount of signal to noise ratio out of them, that's going to be a huge advantage and decrease us the amount of time that we're spinning our wheels. You can never be totally sure. Obviously, you're taking some sort of a probabilistic guess on some of those things we're leaving outside of it, but ultimately you have to do something. You have to put your money where your mouth is and ultimately make a decision and craft a training program. So I think that's going to be the best probabilistic case of going about it. So that to me is the first advantage. And the second advantage is actually from the training perspective, I think, is giving you the directionality of troubleshooting things. If we can have the highest, most controlled understanding of the different principles of training, understanding how those operate in a directional sense, I think is ultimately going to give you the ability to use those principles to actually troubleshoot things on the individual level. Just as a basic example, if let's say we can agree that additional training volume is going to improve our outcomes on average. If I run into a plateau for an individual and the overall conditions seem that I can add training volume, that's probably a good idea, given that that seems to improve outcomes on average. So that kind of thing, it gives you directionality of troubleshooting. Otherwise, if we're saying that every single training principle is completely individual and there's essentially no predictable physiology that we can base things on, you're saying that there's an equal probability of taking somebody down to like zero sets per week or 40 sets per week in terms of maximizing their outcomes. Whereas if we understand this overall relationship, we can make much more reasonable estimates on what's going to actually maximize outcomes on the ground. So those are the two reasons I think it's beneficial. And I think that's basically how I would recommend using it. We have aspirations on, this is again, kind of the topic of my PhD that I initially thought was going to be really inspiring. And this project was going to give us a ton of answers. And I now realize we have a lot of work to do to get to the thing that I'm excited about. But someday I envision a world where instead of chasing down kind of the average group level effects, which is what a lot of research focus on, we'll eventually get to researching predictors of individual responses and things we can focus on from that perspective, where we can take those directly into working with an individual and be able to make modifications from there much more in a streamlined fashion instead of kind of guessing based on population averages. But in the absence of that evidence, I do think the group level effects are going to be pretty stable and are going to be our best bet. So that's how I think research is useful. As far as staying tapped in and ultimately utilizing that from a coach's perspective, I think that's where the new age of science communication makes things challenging, because it ultimately depends on the philosophical nature of what degree of understanding does somebody need to have for that information to be useful. And that's where I don't think I've spent enough time thinking about this, but I do think my opinion has changed on that over time. in the sense that, you know, obviously, you know, you could call it sunken costs a little bit to some degree, but we put a lot of time into, you know, trying to learn how to read papers, understand that at a very high level, understand the limitations, all those kind of things. But at the same time, that is going to limit somebody's ability to coach, get experience. That's ultimately going to help their clients, time investment that they can give to their clients. There's just an opportunity cost there to some degree for somebody to learn all of those skills. So, you know, that's why I just think science communicators are a huge advantage. You know, you have research reviews nowadays, you have high quality science communicators that have a good amount of domain knowledge and talk to experts frequently, but break things down in a really simple way that ultimately I think is going to give you the kind of the Pareto principle there, the 80-20 out of there of watching a Jeff Nippert YouTube video where he breaks things down really succinctly. I think you're going to get the vast majority of the benefit than going to, you know, hunting down every single one of the original research studies and the latest meta-analysis for the average practitioner. I don't think that's practical, and I don't really think that's necessary, really. It just comes down to understanding that every source of information like that does come with some limitations, but as long as you're digesting it with kind of that lens and understanding that, you know, probably some of the limitations are going to be glossed over, probably, you know, there's a higher likelihood if it's not coming directly from the people that did the analysis, there's a few things that could have got lost in translation in terms of, you know, the things you can and cannot say based on the way that the analysis was run, certain things like that. As long as you kind of understand that and have just like a layer of caution in terms of what you're utilizing there, I think for the vast, vast majority of people, that's kind of where things are heading. The one thing that gets even more challenging with kind of today's landscape of how that types of information is being disseminated is that when I used to think fitness science communication, I used to think YouTube and 10 minute videos and 15 minute videos and maybe an occasional interview. And then it kind of shifted to podcasts, and I know podcasts is even longer form. So that's even better, more context, that kind of stuff. And now we're completely on the other side of the spectrum where we get a 30-second clip on what exercise is the best for the lower lats, and boom, there you go. Right. So that's, I think that gets challenging more when that's the kind of most common medium in which information is consumed, where I think you have a greater degree of caution there. So ultimately, I think it's about finding that middle ground in terms of, yes, we completely acknowledge that spending the time, energy, resources to literally read all the studies yourself is probably impractical and probably passes the point of being useful outside of you finding it interesting and potentially utilizing that in some way. But if you're purely about getting the information from those sources, I think this is the unfortunate reality where you just have to rely on other people that are dedicating their time and effort towards science communication. And I think that's where we get kind of the symbiotic relationship where coaches, you know, get information on the ground, give that to the researchers do the research, get that to the science communicators feed new information to coaches. And that cycle is just kind of like a symbiotic relationship where everybody kind of needs each other. And I think that gets us kind of the nice little pep talk here to wrap things up, that we all, you know, kind of play an important role in the process. And I think more conversations like this are good to kind of expose that. And I think everybody kind of realizes that in today's landscape. But I think the kind of science communication fitness stuff is in a general sense more popular than it has been and kind of over the years. So I think it's all headed in the right direction. I think more people are starting to realize the utility of science-based tools, but also the limitations. And that's kind of the way things should go. So I don't know how long I just talked for, but I'm now reflecting on it. I feel like it was too long. So hopefully that was okay.
We're drawing to a close here. We've already talked for over an hour. I had like a really nice question that I thought was super smart framed up to ask you to close it out, but you kind of touched on several pieces of it there already. So I thought that was really cool. Before I kind of ask it to close it out, I really liked your phrase, new age of science communication. That's something that's going to be rattling around my brain for a while. I think I am a little bit optimistic that pendulum is starting to swing back a little bit. You're not the first guest on the podcast to argue that like maybe not every coach needs to be going to primary source research all the time and things like that. And it wasn't that long ago where you like couldn't be taken seriously on social media unless every claim you posted had a PMID next to it. Yeah. And like, we're starting to get into an era where people are realizing that, like, maybe leave that to like professionals who know the body of the literature and can provide you a summary of all of it and are not relying on one study with flawed methods, yada, yada, yada. So I think that that message is starting to get out there. I think you're not crazy for saying it by any means, right? So what I kind of wanted to ask to close it, and you did touch on some of this, is that, and I was thinking fundamental flaws, but it's not a flaw. Are there fundamental things about how research is conducted that limits its applicability to practice? And the things I'm thinking about here are, as you mentioned, research is all about removing all the variables other than the one you're looking at, but practice is all about accounting for all of those variables. Research is all about prioritizing the biggest adaptation over the shortest period of time, but practice is about long-term sustainability. Research is finding the average group level effect, but practice is knowing when you're looking at somebody who's an outlier and adjusting appropriately. Like, are there fundamental divides there that make research not as applicable to practice as people might want it to be?
So my short answer here is, with the current body of knowledge we have from the research, the answer is yes, there are considerable limitations. However, every single one of those processes or examples that you just provided, for example, detecting someone that's an outlier and adjusting accordingly, we don't have great research for how to do that right now, right? So in the absence of that, the best thing we have are practical tools that people have learned. And it might be research informed in terms of the directionality of said adjustment, right? But maybe where I'll push back a little bit is that the best tool that we have in order to come at the best possible answer in the long term would be the research for that, for example. But that is extraordinarily hard, and we're so far away from that that you're going to have to learn those skills in the meantime, is basically how I think about it, right? Are we ever going to have hundreds of long-term training studies? Probably not. So you're going to have those skills and learn those tools from people that have been coaching for a while or from your own experience for how to make, kind of adapt the principles with long-term considerations in mind, because most studies are limited to 12 weeks. But theoretically, the best way to answer these issues would be through research. So I think philosophically, science and the scientific method is the best way to get these answers. But dude, like, it's exercise science. We don't, like, the funding's just not there. I wish it was, but like, we're studying healthy people, often spending our own money to get equipment. Like, that, like, yeah, if there were millions of dollars flowing through it, maybe we'd have answers. It's going to be slow because the money's not there, the funding's not there. But I think it's moving in the right direction, and I'd like to think at least to some degree it's accelerating. For example, like the last couple months, I've been spending a lot of time extracting data as far back as I can find, right? Papers from like the 60s, the 70s, even, for a meta-analysis. And that makes me optimistic, right? Because of the tools we had in the 60s and the 70s compared to now, right? And I think, again, some of that technology, those methods are only accelerating. And I guess our goal and things that give me optimism is being a small part of that improvement, of that, you know, contributing to better methods and getting closer to the truth. But you're absolutely right that we don't have answers to a lot of these things from research. And in the absence of that, you got to have those practical tools.
I think the grass is probably a little bit greener than maybe we realize. Like, I think we just talked about some of the technology that's going to be on the rise. And I think that's going to give us access to research designs and stuff that we've never had access to. I think Josh said it perfectly. Like, basically right now, what we're doing is we're making certain assumptions with the research that we have and some fundamental limitations that don't totally square with the questions that we're looking to answer. Basic example you already mentioned is kind of the duration of a study, right? We're making the assumption that the treatment effect or the comparison between conditions within a 12-week training study basically extrapolates over the course of your training career. That may or may not be true. And I think quite literally it's better than nothing, and it's more informed than having no data on that, right? So I would still use that to inform kind of long-term training things. However, to kind of more squarely answer what we're interested in, I do think as some of this stuff starts to come out where we have, you know, bunches of training apps that collect data constantly from all these people in their training, from very well-trained individuals that potentially could do like A/B testing or different things like that, where we have some sort of these more complex, potentially more ecologically valid, long-running training studies with way more participants that we could ever get on the ground in a lab. Obviously, those come with those own limitations, but it kind of solves things from the other end of the coin. And to me, the thing we need to verify that would give us more or less confidence in the body of research that we have is if we research one of these things that we kind of think is pretty well known, and we go to kind of the other end of the spectrum, you know, long duration study, really well-trained individuals, maybe more like sustainable approach, as opposed to thinking really short-term effects, and the directionality is completely different than what we saw in those kind of shorter term studies, then maybe we need to start rethinking things. If I had to guess, I don't think that would be the case based on most things we have and just kind of thinking about it logically and trying to think about how physiology would operate in those different conditions. But of course, I could be wrong. The biggest thing to me that we just don't know about is the kind of the ceiling effects situation that you have as you kind of get closer to your genetic potential. Do these things that we do to try to optimize our outcomes in 12 weeks actually lead us to greater things and then kind of the down the road, or is it just kind of getting to us to that point faster? Do we just hit this kind of rate of adaptation that we kind of max out and we could get there a ton of different ways? There's a ton of different questions there philosophically that we can't really answer with the stuff that we have, but I'm optimistic in the future as we get access to kind of some more of these alternative sources of data. I think we'll get some ability to kind of cross-reference some of these questions that'll give us some more confidence in the stuff that we have, I think.
That makes sense. Well, we started this conversation with you guys telling us what led to the creation of data-driven strength. And I guess it would only make sense then to close it out by asking you guys, what is the best place for people to go to find more about what you guys are doing?
Yeah, the best way to keep up with us is probably to subscribe to our newsletter. So if you go to our website, just press on the newsletter tab. Website is data-drivenstrength.com. You can sign up there and keep up with our free stuff. You can also find us on Instagram. I'm josh.datadrivenstrength and Zach is zach.datadrivenstrength. You can also find us on ResearchGate if you're interested in like our academic work. So if you just Google like Zach Robinson ResearchGate or Josh Pelland ResearchGate, you can find some of the stuff we have put out and that will be updated with future stuff that comes out as well. So that's where you can find us.
And all of that, awesome, as usual, will be in the show notes.
Yeah, well, guys, thank you for coming on. I know we sort of prefaced this by saying we would go in a million different places, and I think that's exactly what we did, which was perfect. So thank you for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, appreciate you. Thanks for having us on.
This was great. And, different stuff.
Yeah, it was cool to talk about different stuff, and also it's cool to hear your guys' insights from, yeah, just honestly a very different field compared to what we're usually thinking about. So it also gave us some things to think about for sure. So we appreciate it.
Oh, geez. Well, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in-depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, Our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.
Thank you.